Alice, you have made a remarkable ethnographic study of an inner city neighborhood in Philadelphia, and especially of the young men you got to know there. Why did you want to tell their story?
It wasn't the story that I was planning to tell. I started out in this neighborhood when I was an undergraduate at Penn, and then I continued on all through grad school for like 6 more years from when I got started. And originally I was interested in, it was like a fieldwork class that I took. It was just a class where you were supposed to learn how to do what's called participant observation, and that is taking a job or spending a lot of time in a place and trying to understand the everyday life of a particular neighborhood or a particular group of people. So I got this job in a cafeteria on campus, and I was trying to understand kind of what campus was like for the people who worked at the university. And the workers there were mostly African-American men and women, and they were serving a mostly white, pretty wealthy group of students who were sometimes quite rude to them. And I just wanted to know kind of what it was like on the other side of that. And so I got this job in a cafeteria. And then from there, so I like wrote up a little paper about that. And then from there, I started tutoring the grandkids of my boss at the cafeteria. And that's when I first went to this neighborhood. And when I got there, I remember like the first time driving to this tutoring session in the evening, I got out of my car and someone stopped me and asked me if I was a cop or a caseworker. Like there was no other reason why a white woman like me would be around. And so, you know, it's like levels of segregation are pretty high in this country. And I was on the other side of that. So,
and eventually you were tutoring these kids, and then you got to know some young men there.
So Aisha, who I was tutoring, her cousin Ronnie came home from a juvenile detention center. He was 14 and he had been locked up for a while. And so she introduced me to him. We started hanging out with him in his neighborhood, which was about 10 minutes away. And then he introduced me to Mike, his older cousin. And a few weeks after meeting Mike, he was charged with a shooting. And like he had this shooting charge. The police came to his...
Wait, this was Ronnie or Mike?
This is Mike, yeah, mm-hmm. Who was 22 at the time. I was 21. So a few weeks after we met, the police raided his uncle's house in the middle of the night, and his uncle called him and said, you better leave your girlfriend's house. They're going to be there next. So he called me the next day and told me what happened. And then he was like a fugitive. He was on the run from the police. And that's kind of, that case is sort of what brought me into this project. And I at first thought it was a very unique experience for him. And then I realized later that this was the third criminal charge he had pending. He was on probation. He was going to court dates for other things. And it wasn't just him. Lots of other guys in the neighborhood had sort of pending legal entanglements, sometimes for being accused of violent crimes, but also sometimes for small amounts of drugs. And the violent crimes, too, were not the way I thought about violent crimes either. Like sometimes they were just a fight in the schoolyard. So people were cased up. Mike and his friends were cased up. That's how I got into it.
Cased up meaning they were basically in and out of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, they had pending court cases. They had pending charges that then they had to appear for court almost every month, like sometimes for a year, year and a half, 2 years, until the case settled, and usually didn't go to trial. Usually they either plea bargained and took some time, did some time, or the charges were dropped. And not only did they have cases pending, but they were on probation, they were on parole, they had open warrants for failures to pay court fines and fees, and they were being, the police were massively present in the neighborhood and in their lives. So like so when I started thinking about, so I asked Mike if I could write about his life, and he said, yeah. And then I met his friend Chuck, who was at that point in county jail. And then I met his friend Alex, who was working at his dad's heating and air conditioning repair shop and had done time but was now out of prison.
So why were all these young guys having so much trouble with the legal system?
Yeah, well, at first I was like, okay, are this group of friends that I've gotten to know like the kind of bad apples of the neighborhood? Like, There must be, I had already met lots of families who were steering clear of the criminal justice system, and I sort of thought it must be like this very small group of people that that I just have happened to get to know. Then I did this survey of the neighborhood with Chuck, one of Mike's good friends, once he came home from county jail. And we found that 2/3 of the men in the neighborhood had been arrested or had been in jail, pretty recently.
And these were all African American men.
Yeah, and the thing is like, it's not because there's a level of crime that is like over and above what's happening in lots of other neighborhoods. It's really about changes in policing and imprisonment. So. Beginning in the late 1970s, the United States started this massive social experiment in punishment. And this wasn't punishment leveled like across the population. It was really targeted at Black and also Latino communities. So the level of policing in Mike and Chuck's neighborhood was a different world from anything I had seen in the white neighborhood that I had grown up in or on Penn's campus. So like the first year and a half I spent in the neighborhood, I watched the police stop people, search people, make arrests, chase people through the street every day except 5 days in the first 18 months. And this is just like in a little 4-block radius. Wow.
Was presumably a high crime area?
No, that's the thing. It wasn't. It was a middle class. It was a mixed income African-American neighborhood that if you live in the white part of town nearby, people living in that section thought of it as like the hood. But a lot of people in this larger African-American section of the city considered this neighborhood to be a really nice neighborhood. And it was wealthier than like the neighborhood that I was living in 10 blocks away. So it had nicer lawns. It had a lower crime rate. And later when I interviewed police, it was like not on their radar at all. So like it wasn't like a hot spot for crime. It wasn't one of their like top 10 neighborhoods to watch or something. It was like very calm compared to other areas around. So the level of policing that
So why? Why were the police there so much?
Because we are in a tough on crime. We're in this experiment with punishment, and it's a punishment that's being directed at African American communities and poor African American communities. Since 1970, we've raised our incarceration rates by 5 times. We now imprison 5 to 8 times more people than any European nation, more people than China, more people than Rwanda per capita. It's never happened before in American history, and it's really happening to poor African American men and their families at a rate that's completely disproportionate to the amount of crime that people in those communities are committing or to any other period of history.
So tell me about some of these guys you met and got to know very well, Mike and Chuck. What kind of lives did they lead?
So Chuck, I met him when he was 18. He's Mike's really good friend, and they grew up together in this neighborhood that I call Sixth Street. And I met him when he was sitting in county jail on trial for an aggravated assault charge. And I met him by starting to go with Mike to visit him in county jail. And first time I had been in a jail. And he had been he had made it all the way through high school without any jail time, which he was super proud of. He had made it to 18, and when in his senior year of high school, he got into a fight in the schoolyard. This is before we met. He got into a fight in the schoolyard with a kid who had called his mom a crack whore, and he pushed the kid's face into the snow, and then the school cops charged him with aggravated assault. So he had this aggravated assault charge, and since he was 18, he was in the adult system. So he was pulled out of school and had this pending trial going for 8 months of his senior year while he sat in county jail, and he couldn't make the bail because he couldn't afford it. So at the end of that, almost all the charges were dismissed. He just had to pay like a couple $100 in court fees. So then when he came home, after that period, he spent the summer at home, didn't get into any trouble, tried to re-enroll again as a senior the next year, And the secretary told him that he couldn't enroll because he was 19 and that was too old. So, like, then he was a high school dropout. And then he couldn't pay the court fees that came due after his case ended. So then he had a bench warrant out for the court fees. So then he was a fugitive. And that's, like, the kind of point of the book. It's, like, it's not just that the United States is now massively imprisoning African-American young men and returning them home with felony convictions. It's that there's this whole underside of the criminal justice system that's much less visible, that's about surveillance and policing, and that is creating a kind of fugitive life, not just for guys with warrants, but for people on probation or parole, young men living in neighborhoods like this who are worried that any moment they will be seized.
So it sounds like you're saying that there can be what would seem to be fairly minor incidents that totally change someone's life, and basically that change their lives in a direction that then becomes sort of trafficking in trafficking outside the legal system.
Minor and major, and I think part of the important point to make is that we shouldn't separate the people. We shouldn't draw like a moral line between the people who are sitting in prison or who have a pending court case for like a small drug charge versus like a violent charge or some kind of other thing that seems more major to us. Because I think that part of what acute poverty and dislocation from the labor market is about is Can I back up on that?
Sure, absolutely.
Can you ask again?
So I was asking whether it was it sounds like there are often these kind of almost minor incidents that trigger a life that ends up putting people outside the legal system.
Yeah, so Tim's first arrest, Tim is Chuck's youngest brother. There's three brothers, Chuck, Reggie, and Tim. And Tim's first arrest came when he was 11. His older brother, Chuck, was driving him to school in his girlfriend's car, and the cops stopped them, ran the tags, and the car came up as stolen in California. So they charged Chuck with receiving stolen property, and they charged his younger brother, Tim, age 11, with accessory to receiving stolen property. So then he was placed on probation, which then he violated later for another very small thing. So that's what set him down the path. Mike, Chuck's very good friend, his first arrest came at 13 when he was stopped and searched and found in possession of a very small amount of marijuana. So when you think about those kinds of things, you know, it's like at the same time that I was doing that, I was living in this neighborhood and writing notes every day about what the police were doing and the level of surveillance and arresting, I was also like commuting to Penn and then Princeton for class. So then I got to watch this whole other group of men who were also young men and also getting into different things like
you probably saw a lot of the kids at the University of Penn smoking pot too, and
yeah,
they probably
pot,
never faced
like,
any
much harder
legal
drugs like at frat parties. Yeah, so it was amazing to me to see the contrast, like not very many blocks away. Well, when I was at Penn, not many blocks away, and then in Princeton it was an hour away, but here all these mostly white students, elite students on college campuses. And there's drugs, and there's drunk driving, and there's fights, and there's rape. You know, we hear a lot about that these days. And these kids are graduating with degrees in English and business and sociology and not felony convictions. I'm not denying a level of violence in poor communities that is over and above what you get on a college campus. Like, you know, many of the young men that I write about were killed. But what gets people started down this path is very similar things to what the young men on Princeton or Penn or University of Wisconsin's campus are doing and are totally protected from the consequences of that. So I think, you know, we're in this moment of reform that's very exciting. For the first time in four decades, there's a real policy push and a lot of conversations around changing a racially unjust criminal justice system. And I think, you know, part of what we want to think about there is justice in the kinds of policing that different groups of young men are facing as they come of age.
Now, part of what's so remarkable about this story is your own background. I mean, you're white. You're from a privileged background. You were going to an Ivy League school, University of Pennsylvania, and And then you start. You move into this inner city black neighborhood, and my impression is you were still going to school, but you pretty much sort of abandoned the college way of life, and I mean this sort of became your world here.
Well, you know, it's funny, at Penn, it's pretty close by, so like these two worlds are running parallel to each other, and then they meet in all kinds of interesting ways. So Penn is nestled within a historically African American neighborhood, and parts of it are very poor and working class, and so the university has this complicated relationship with the neighborhood, like many universities that are in African American neighborhoods or right next to them, University of Chicago, you know, Columbia. So there's a whole history there, and I think kind of being in this sort of going back and forth between these two communities, I learned a lot about each from doing that. And also, you know, there's a lot of people who grew up in African American neighborhoods or Latino neighborhoods, and then who come to places like Penn and then have to negotiate these two worlds.
So what was it like for you going the other direction? I mean, you know, from this very white environment and then moving into this black neighborhood and getting to know these people really well. Was that a hard transition for you?
I think I was trying to take, I was trying to be a sociologist, and I think I was kind of trying to be in this tradition of Du Bois and Drake and Caton and Eli Anderson, sociologists who are trying to understand the city and trying to understand American inequality and trying to understand the kind of processes by which unequal groups are produced. And I think part of that is this deep engagement in a community and note-taking and trying to understand different parts of a community.
But I would think, I mean, just at a more basic level, these young black guys must have been wondering, you know, what's this white girl doing here? I mean, was it hard for you to connect with them at first, at least?
I came in through Aisha, this young woman I had been tutoring, and then her cousin. So like by the time I met Mike, I had already been living in the neighborhood and I already had a lot of ties. So I think that kind of transition, so in a lot of ways it was more strange for the people. So like I think it was strange for Mike and his friends sometimes more than it was strange for me. Because, well, can I start over?
Mm-hmm,
can
sure.
you ask it again?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's scrap that.
Yeah. So I was, the question of, you know, sort of this, you know, young white student coming and, you know, hanging out with these black guys. And was that a, you know, how did that work? I mean, sort of, you know, these two cultures coming together.
Yeah, it's almost hard for me to remember what that time was like. And in writing the appendix, I spent like a year writing that appendix, and I went back to my field notes to try to see actually what had happened at different points and not just give a kind of retrospective from my own memory, which was its own sort of interesting experiment. But I think one thing that I learned is that you can... So there were a lot of people who were super welcoming and who really were like happy to have me around, and there were other people who were very dismissive and who were suspicious and who sometimes just sort of called me out like, "What are you doing here? What, you know?" And I think all of that was important, and like it. So like Mike's mom and I became very close, and at some point she said to me, "You know, you're like Mike's right hand. You know, like he's you know, he doesn't have a sister, but you're the closest thing to that."
And didn't Mike start referring to you as his adopted sister?
Yeah, he didn't. He was an only child, and I, you know, I didn't grow up with a brother either. So, but that also can become very tenuous at points, you know. So like there were the kind of racial politics of this country are fraught, and I think there's a lot of kind of unanswered ethical questions about doing research coming from where I was coming from. And I think in some ways, like, you know, you don't really find a way out of that, out of those questions, or a good answer to those questions. So like on a bad day, it's like, well, what gives me the right to be here and be writing about, you know, a neighborhood that I didn't come from?
Well, and you talk about in your book about there were times when, you know, you'd be at your laptop typing notes from what you'd been seeing, and Mike and some of his friends were there kind of looking at your notes and sort of, you know, as you were writing about their lives. And it's sort of this fascinating portrait of an ethnographic study at work. And I guess it makes me wonder, you know, what did they think of your project, your sociological project?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very collaborative in the sense that when I started, it started as an undergrad thesis, and I talked to Mike about what he thought about me writing about his life, and I didn't even really know what I was going to write about at that point, and the undergrad thesis didn't have any of the same themes of the book, and, you know, life is rich, right? You can write about all kinds of things, and he thought that was cool, and he thought it was cool to have somebody sort of chronicling all the things that were happening to him and his friends. And
did he impose any restrictions on what you wrote?
He said, when we had the first conversation, he said, okay, but like, I understand that you're going to be taking notes, but like, whenever things happen that I want you to leave out, you have to leave them out. And so I said, absolutely, you know, yes, great. And then as time went on, like, so then sometimes I became like the kind of person who had the record. So people would ask me, like, didn't that thing happen? I told you, you know, that I was talking to so-and-so the other day, and she said that we were at this party and this other person was there, but that person wasn't there. That person was locked up then. So it couldn't have been him who stole my wallet. Like, what do your notes say? You know, so I had to learn to like not weigh in those times, because I, you know, memories evolve and people's relationships evolve, and you don't necessarily want someone who has a record. And not to say that my record was like any more true than anybody else's memory either, you know. So there was that. There was also like sometimes people really changed how they felt about the project over time. Like, so Alex was Mike and Chuck's very good friend, and when I first told him that I was thinking about writing this senior thesis, like later it was a dissertation and a book, but at first the notes were just this senior thesis, and he was like, absolutely not. Like, what does a white girl know? Like, you don't know anything about us. You have totally no legitimacy to do this project. And he had been he hadn't spent as much time with Mike and Chuck and other guys that I was hanging out with since he had come home from prison and had started working at his dad's shop. So he was kind of in and out. And in my mind, I tried to sort of tell myself, like, maybe that's why he doesn't really trust me. But really, like, you know, it was a totally legitimate thing for him to say, like, you have no right to this story, you know. And so I said to him, okay, I won't put you in any of the notes. Like, I'll just keep you completely out of it. I won't try to write about your life. I won't try to talk about you or anything that happens to you. I totally respect that, you know. And then, like, a couple years later, he was like, it was like, maybe I had that conversation with someone else about how he was not in the notes. And he came to me and he was like, I'm not in the book. Like, he was totally irate. Like, he was like, what do you mean I'm not in the book? Like, all these interesting things have happened to me. I've been through so much in the past, like, 5 years. Are you telling me, like, I'm just going to be cut out of this whole manuscript? Like, at that point, it was, you know, it had a different theme. It was a book. And he was, like, really, really upset. And so I was like, oh, my God, you know, like, this is horrible. Like, I'm really, like, I then, you know, it was, like, all of a sudden everything was flipped around. And then I was, like, keeping him out of people knowing about his life, you know? Like, I was this kind of barrier between him and like his audience, you know, or like what he wanted to say about life. And so I was like, okay, like, you know, like, I will start writing notes from now on, and like, you know, like, if I possibly can, like, you'll be on the first page, you know. And like, now he is, you know, it like opens with the story of Alex getting pistol whipped and robbed, and then not being able to go to the hospital because he's worried that the police will be there and arrest him. So,
which is an amazing thing in itself. I mean, one of the things you write about is how a lot of these guys, even if they got really hurt, I mean, pistol whipped, even shot, they would do anything to avoid going to the hospital, going to the ER, because they were worried the cops might catch them there.
Yeah, in the first few years of doing this research, I would just hang out in the ER and watch the police walk black men in handcuffs out of the ER. It was like an amazingly great place to make their stats, to find people to arrest. And, you know, when you're on the other side of it, it seems really surprising that people don't go to the hospital when they're injured. But living in this neighborhood and spending most of my time with Mike and Chuck, and it's like obvious, you know, it's like you know, if you want to go to prison, you know, go to the hospital with your injuries. So
are the police the bad guys here?
I mean, we're talking about a neighborhood, we're talking about a community that is in a state of siege. I mean, it's a level of policing that is, you cannot find accounts of this kind of policing and police violence and surveillance unless you look at like East Germany or like other repressive regimes. I mean, so police have always been, policing has always been disproportionately targeting African Americans. African Americans have always been arrested at higher rates and sentenced at higher rates and convicted. So like, that's been a constant in American history. What's changed is just the level of policing, the level of arresting, the number of people moving through the courts. So there's this just huge influx of federal dollars and expansions of police activities.
But I'm assuming from the police perspective, they would say, well, we're, you know, these people are committing crimes. You know,
yeah,
they have to be held accountable.
Totally one way of looking at it. So it's like, you know, a lot of people think about guilt and innocence in that way, where it's like, if you've committed a crime, then you deserve to pay for it. And I think part of what like people like Michelle Alexander have done is kind of shift the conversation so that we start to understand people who are in prison not as people who are rightfully being punished for crimes that they committed, but people who were on the other end of totally disproportionate and historically unique level of policing and arresting. So like, if you stopped and searched every undergrad at this campus that we're on right now, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and arrested all those kids for everything that they had in their pockets or at their parties, and you put them in prison, you could also say, yeah, they were all committing crimes. They deserve to be there. But guess what? They're not there. They're going to class every day. And I also think that we've reached a point where the American labor market is so unreceptive to African-American young men, particularly with low levels of education, that many young men are relying on the drug trade to get by because they're entirely cut out of the formal labor market. So like so when you talk about like, well, it's okay to use drugs, but if you're going to deal drugs, like you should go to prison for that. Or, you know, if you're going to get into violence, shootings and stuff, you know, then you really deserve like lock you up and throw away the key. Well, that's well and good, but you also have to think about the very large numbers of poor African-American young men who are trying every day to get a job and who are getting denied. And then you ask yourself, you know, what is there left? What work is there left in a community where people can't even get jobs at Target? You know, there's a whole amazing, like, you know, we've had this wonderful growth after the civil rights movement of the black middle class. Many, many people have lives that have nothing to do with the criminal justice system. They're not, you know, they're getting stopped, you know, by the police. But they're not spending their young adult lives in prison and, you know, but poor communities. So in some ways, it's like even violent crime we need to understand in the context of this large number of young men who can't get legal work and who are turning to other things to survive.
I want to come back to sort of your own story and how, you know, again, given your background, I mean, this was not the world that you had been exposed to as you were growing up. And I mean, you write about how you had to kind of learn how to live in this other culture. I mean, you had to dress differently, listen to different music. Can you talk about that? I mean, sort of what you did to sort of become more familiar with a culture that you hadn't really known very much about at first?
I mean, I grew up in Philly, so like I already was listening to hip hop and I already, you know, like I grew up in schools that were not hyper segregated, at least some of the schools that I went to. But yeah, I grew up in a middle class, upper middle class fairly white neighborhood in downtown Philadelphia. And so this was a very different neighborhood. And I think one of the things that I really needed to learn how to do, was to have a totally different orientation and relationship to the police. So like in the neighborhood that I grew up in, the police aren't there very much. And when they're there, you're like really happy they're there. It's like, oh, great, police officer. If anything happens to me, I'll be able to call on you. So like when I got to this, to 6th Street, you know, the police are an occupying force. Like 52 times in the first 18 months, I watched the police raid houses, chase people through houses, break down doors. I think like 14 times I watched the police punch, choke, beat, stomp on, beat with their nightsticks young men after they had chased them down and cuffed them in the street.
You had seen this personally.
Yeah. Yeah. I was taking notes every day. I was taking field notes every day about what the police were doing. And the police, they weren't even the theme of my field notes at that point. It was just part of the notes that I took every day. So then I went back the year later and counted all the times from the daily field notes. So you have to learn how to run. You have to learn when the police are coming, and you have to learn how to run from them. And you have to learn what the undercovers look like, and you have to learn who else around you may have a warrant or may have heat on them for various reasons, and then who to avoid. And it's this whole strategy of negotiating everyday life so that you can run at a moment. You have to learn where to hide.
Did you find yourself having to run at times?
Yeah, and the thing was like, yeah, so the first time I really remember, I walked up to Chuck's house, and Chuck and Reggie were both home from prison and jail that year, and Chuck came running out of the house and said, like, the cops are coming, and I think Reggie had a warrant during that time, so Chuck took off, and Reggie too, and they were like, come on, let's go. So we ran through the neighborhood, and I remember getting very out of breath, and like I was not used to running like that. And then we got to this, and then I lost them, and then I heard them through the doorway of this woman whose house I had never been to before in the neighborhood, and she was like this very church-going, wonderfully proper woman, and they were upstairs in her like boudoir. Like she had this amazing dressing room. Who knew? She was like a huge clothes horse. So we were up there waiting out the cops who had come for someone on the house down. And it was like, you know, we've got to clear out. So we waited there for a while, and you kind of get this inertia of like, okay, we've run, and you know, it's like, there's a little bit of kind of not excitement, but sort of like, okay, we made it, you know? So I remember like sitting there, and like Reggie was like online looking at pit bulls on her laptop, and Reggie and Chuck were joking with each other about like, Reggie was like, you know, you can't run at all now that you got that little shell in your shoulder. Like he had caught this gunfire a couple weeks before and had this shell injury, and Chuck was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm in great shape, and, you know.
But I have to say that this takes a participant observation study to extremes here. You know, the fact that, you
well,
know.
Not really.
You're on the run, too.
No, because the police were totally ignoring me most of the time. Like, I only got pulled in for questioning, like, twice in all those years. Like, most of the time, like, that's the thing, right? It's very race-based. So, like, they're not interested in white women. Like, they are not interested in women as much as men, and white women, like, almost not at all. So, like, I was almost invisible to the police a lot of the time, or, like, they would just walk right by me. So, like, so many times I would be, like, outside with a group of guys, and then the police would stop and search every single person, and I would just still be sitting there, and the police just wouldn't bother me at all. So it's like they had a totally different way of treating white and black people. And that's the other thing, too, is, like, I often had this thought, like, if I were an African-American grad student man trying to do this study, like, I wouldn't have gotten through all these years. I would have been arrested and then had a felony conviction, and then I wouldn't have gotten this job at the university. Like, how would I even have done this kind of study, you know? But the other thing, too, is, like, when you talk about participant observation, like if you're interested in learning about waitresses, you get a job as a waitress. If you're interested in learning about, you know, unionization, you get a job, you know, working in construction. Like you take on the kind of everyday activities of the people that you're trying to understand. So in one sense, it's like, This was participant observation light because I never sold drugs, I never got arrested, I never went to prison, I never caught cases.
Although you do say in your book that at one point you wondered whether you should get arrested. So,
because you're trying to
see the criminal justice system from the inside.
Yeah, and then on the other hand, that's absurd, right? Because everyone I knew was trying to avoid the police and the courts and prisons as much as possible. So it's like it would be almost like this kind of yeah, I mean, and actually when I got this job at the university, I asked if I could do the next study in prison, and they said, absolutely not. You know, you can't have a felony conviction and work here. So I'm trying to negotiate now to figure out how to do research in prison without a felony conviction, but as an inmate. But that's, you know, it's hard. I mean, the thing is, if you want to understand American poverty today, it's like, you need to go to prisons because that's where people are living. That's where we are, you know. 2/3 of African-American men who didn't graduate from high school will go to prison by the time they turn 30. So so more researchers need to be there.
Now, you've talked about how you saw a fair amount of violence.
Can I also say,
anybody
who's behind bars right now, hi, we're thinking about you today. I just want to say you're on my mind, and for those of you who have been writing to me, who have looked at the book, thank you. Thanks for writing in. Thanks for your thoughts. Thanks for telling me what's happening, and I'm wishing you strength.
You also you've talked about how you saw a lot of things, saw violence by the police, by other people. You saw a couple of murders, didn't you?
I was once in a crowd of people and watched Aisha's sister's boyfriend. The police chased him down and then strangled him, and he died. The paper actually reported. Well, I don't want to get into that. Confidentiality is something I'm paranoically. Concerned with. But anyway, I did watch the police strangle someone who died, and there was talk in the family about suing the police department, and that didn't get off the ground. I also watched I was in a car when a guy who I actually didn't know, he was getting out of my car and was shot, and I didn't know if he died or not, and everybody ran, including me. There have been articles about the book that say I saw, like, they didn't quite read, or maybe I didn't phrase it right, but there are, things that I saw according to the reviews that I didn't actually see. I just was there a few hours later. But this issue of violence is a pressing one. And I think that it would be really great if we can think about violence as one of the key kind of problems that are facing poor communities of color, and try to think about different ways of solving this problem of violence rather than arresting all the people involved. The people that I knew who were involved in violence were the victims and the perpetrators of it. They were on both sides of it, and they didn't want to be doing any of it. I think that there's the way that we're addressing violence in this country is short-sighted and devastating. And so it's like, in addition to dealing with violence, the community that I spent this time in is also dealing with a massive police presence, because so many people are worried about going to prison. People can't turn to the police when they are worried about what will happen to them. And I think also condemning all the people involved in violence is sort of cruel and short-sighted, because these are also the victims. and people who are looking for a different life than the one that they're in. Yeah.
Well, this book is getting a lot of attention now and a lot of praise. I mean, it's among other things, just a remarkable feat of reporting. You've also gotten some criticism, and one of the lines of criticism is that because you saw so much, you became very close friends with some of these people you were hanging out with, and you witnessed a fair amount of violence. Were you ever complicit? I mean, how do you sort that out?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are these enduring dilemmas of. So the question really is like, how do you do morally responsible work with a vulnerable group of people who are in a state of legal precariousness on questions of pressing moral urgency? How do you do that work ethically? How do you report on what is happening in corners of the country that have very little voice in mainstream politics? Ethically and responsibly, how do you write about these problems of pressing moral urgency? And I think that the way I did it isn't some kind of treatise on methods. It's not a kind of how-to manual. It's just what I did. And I think every day I was struggling with these ethical issues, and I continue to struggle with them, and I don't think I have any answers. I do think that it's important to bear witness, and I think to do that in a way that honors the people that that I got to know. Yeah.
Near the end of your book, you talk about something really tragic that happened. One of the men you'd become very close to, Chuck, was killed. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, Chuck was the peacemaker in the group. He spent a lot of time trying to mend the fences. So there were, you know, a lot of guys are going to work and school every day, and then another group of guys in the neighborhood are caught up in the courts. They've been pulled out of school into jail and prison and juvenile detention, and they're making money at the very bottom of the drug trade and living, and sleeping on the couches of female relatives and trying to eke out an existence in an illegal economy that is now hyper policed and dangerous. There'd been this dispute between the Sixth Street Boys and the Fourth Street Boys, and Chuck had been someone who was really kind of going between the groups and trying to squash the beef. And he saw a guy from Fourth Street outside of the Chinese store. I wasn't there. But his girlfriend was nearby and said what she thinks happened is that he saw the guy saw him, the guy kind of made a move, Chuck made a move. Chuck didn't even have a gun on him, but the guy thought he might have. And then this guy shot him in the head. So I got the call from Mike saying Chuck's been shot in the head, at which point Mike was like in the suburbs at that point, like an hour away. And I had seen Chuck like the day before, I think. Like I was seeing him every day during that period, and like we had had cheese fries and talked the day before. And anyway, so Mike called and said Chuck's been shot in the head, and I was like, well, like how bad is it? Because like a bullet had grazed Mike's head a while back, and you know we didn't even go to the ER; it was just a graze. So I was sort of trying to figure out like, and Mike was like, he got shot in the fucking head. How bad do you think it is? You know, something along those lines. And so I went to get Mike from the suburbs. We went to the hospital together, and he was at this hospital downtown. And when we drove in, there were like 30 guys from the neighborhood standing watch outside of the ER, like holding this vigil for Chuck. And I remember feeling really awkward as a white woman coming into the scene in downtown Philly where Like, it was clear, like, I wasn't really welcome to stand on the corner with all of his friends and neighbors and sort of stand watch, but I didn't. So I walked into the hospital and asked at the desk, like, what was happening, and they looked at me and then looked at the file and were like, you know, do you actually know him? And do you know? And I was like, yes, he's my cousin. And they were like, well, you know, he got shot in the head, right? I was like, yeah, I know. And so I just waited there. And then nothing was happening. I went home. And then Mike was like, so then the cops cleared everybody off the sidewalk. And at that point, it was really late at night. And then I ended up going back to the hospital because, like, after I had gone home, Mike texted me and said, like, okay, what's the status report? And I was like, well, I've left. Like, I didn't know I was still supposed to be here. And he was like, well, so then I realized, oh, okay, like Mike is expecting that I'll go back. So I'll go back. And at that point, everybody else had gone. So then I kind of like with all my whiteness, like managed to get through the various people at the hospital and get to Chuck's room, which none of his friends were permitted to do. So, which also is like a dilemma, right? It's like, should I be here? I'm here on the basis of my whiteness, you know, being able to be next to Chuck as he dies. Or I didn't know he was going to die at that point. Anyway, so I'm like sitting outside of this this room, and he's got tubes, and there's a TV on. It looks like he's watching it, but he's and his face is swollen and his head is bandaged, and I don't know what's happening at that point. And I text Mike, like, is it okay with his mom if I'm here? Should I even be here? And so I just sat there outside of the ER for many hours, and then it was like a code blue. Like, it actually, like, that's what they said. I thought that was just in the movies, but and so then all these doctors came rushing in, and like his brain, like the bullet, like, had split into his brain. So then I had to call his mom and say, actually, I think I passed the phone to the doctor. And then she told his mom, or somebody there told his mom, that he was not going to make it. And then I sat with him until his girlfriend came and until his other friends came. And his brother Reggie was locked up at the time. He was in county jail. So I was on the phone with him. And then his youngest brother, Tim, was pulled in for questioning because Tim had been really close by when he was killed. So Tim couldn't be there either. So we just sat there in the hospital with him, me and Chuck's girlfriend and other friends from the neighborhood. Mike was pulled in for questioning. Of course I wasn't, because the police, again, ignored me completely. So we just sat there with him, like, as his body grew stiff, and I took the watch that was on the counter that had been his watch and gave it to Tim the next day when he came home from questioning. So, yeah, I got to be there with him when he died.
Wow. For the people who read your book, if there's one thing that you would like them to take away from it and from listening to you about this whole story, about your years of study, what would it be?
So a great juvenile detention reformer, Bart Lubow, in a speech he gave a couple months ago, talked about the insatiable thirst for punishment in American society and insatiable thirst for punishing Black boys and men. And I think the way the criminal justice system is currently operating, we're asking young people who are facing the most challenges in the labor market, who have the fewest resources, with the least amount of education, living in neighborhoods where violence is an everyday threat. We're asking these young people to walk the tightest possible line, to walk a line way tighter than the one any of the rest of us are asked to walk, and certainly tighter than the one I was asked to walk as a rich person with tons of resources, with white parents, growing up in a safe neighborhood. Why are we asking the people who are facing the most challenges to screw up the least? It just doesn't make any sense. Why are we not providing support to young people facing these challenges? Why are we offering handcuffs and jail time and this fugitive existence? We've got to turn this around. That's it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.